A measurement situation is a special case of the more general situation of a system composed of several subsystems. The treatment of subsystems is of crucial importance in all fields of physics, and we will now investigate it in a Bohmian framework. In many physics books and presentations, one often finds a statement like the following. Consider a system composed of certain constituents interacting among themselves. Have you ever thought that this might not really make sense? It might not if one takes it too literally, because taken too literally, it means something like, consider a system composed of certain constituents that interact with each other, but are apart from that, completely isolated from the rest of the universe. So they form a universe on their own. And we just have one universe at our disposal. Of course, nobody making such a statement means it that literally. What is actually meant is, consider a subsystem of our given universe composed of several objects interacting with each other, but just negligibly influenced by the rest of the universe. To check whether this is the case is, in general, trivial in classical mechanics. It is usually enough, or it is enough, that everything else is far enough away from the system under consideration. Let's take as an example the magnetic force. Two magnets always exert a force on each other. Now, if you have a compass and want to check where north is, you should make sure to have no other magnets around. But you do not have to worry about the magnetic field of Mars, for instance. It's just too far away. In quantum mechanics, however, it's not that easy. Let's think of the following example. We have an electron in outer space, very, very far away from everything else, and not interacting with anything else. Nonetheless, this electron could be entangled with another particle on a distant planet. And whatever happens to that particle on the distant planet does influence the state of the electron, even though it's very far away. So, in a quantum setup, or for quantum mechanics, a deeper analysis is required. Luckily, Bohmian mechanics provides us with all the needed tools for such an analysis. And we will now present the analysis. So, as always, simply call the biggest relevant system, so the biggest system relevant for our discussion, the universe. And we will, as always, or as we did before, denote the configuration of the universe by a capital Q. Now, capital Q splits, in our case, into two parts, which we call X and Y. And X should be the part, all the particles, all the coordinates of the particles belonging to the subsystem we are interested in. And Y are all the coordinates of the rest of the universe. Now, what we're looking for, or what we're interested in, is to have a Bohmian description for the subsystem independently of the rest of the universe. So to find a true subsystem description. To be able to treat the Bohmian X system as a Bohmian system on its own, so to speak. In order to achieve that, we have to achieve two goals. First, we need it has to do two purposes. We need to find a wave function for this X system that first guides the X system by the usual Bohmian guidance law, and secondly, satisfies the Schrödinger equation on its own. So let's try to do that. Of course, the entire universe does have a wave function, which we will also denote, as we did before, by capital Psi of X and Y. Now, by the usual Bohmian guidance law, the configuration capital Q of the universe is of course guided by the wave function capital Psi by the usual guidance law. So, looking at this guidance law, we can see that the X configuration does fulfill the following guidance equation. So, the time derivative of the X configuration is the imaginary part, or is given by the imaginary part of Psi star gradient X. So, of course, the gradient here is just with respect to the coordinates of the X system. It's just the X part of the guidance equation. And then we divide, as always, by psi star psi and evaluate at x of t, y of t, and t. Now, having a look at this equation, it seems natural to define the following function, the following wave function. Small phi of x and t is defined as capital psi of x, small x, and capital y. So we plug into the wave function of the universe the actual configuration of the rest of the universe at some time t. And this function also depends explicitly on t. And then we just normalize. So we divide by the square root of the integral of the modulus squared of psi of x plugged in capital Y again of t and t, modulus squared and the square root. Now, looking back at the guidance equation for the x system, we see that this wave function small phi of x and t, which is just a function of the x coordinates, actually guides the x system. So the guidance law for the x system can also be written in terms of the small phi function. So it is the imaginary part, phi star gradient. I will keep the x here, even though the small phi is just a function of x. Small phi star divided by phi, and this is evaluated, of course, at the point x of t and at time t. Now, this wave function here, the small phi, we just defined by plugging into the wave function of the universe the actual configuration of the rest of the universe, so the capital Y of t, is called the conditional wave function, because we condition on the rest of the universe having the actual configuration capital Y of t. Note that the conditional wave function can always be defined. So it is always possible to define the conditional wave function even if the x and the y system strongly depend on each other. But it doesn't really already do what we wanted to have. We've seen that the conditional wave function actually guides the x configuration, but in general it will not satisfy a Schrödinger equation on its own independently of the y system. If this is the case, so in cases where the conditional wave function actually does satisfy an Schrödinger equation on its own, it's called an effective wave function. Now, to see in which cases this is true, so when this is the case, we will first investigate a simple example. So let us suppose that the wave function of the universe has the following form. It is basically a product. So we have psi of x and y is small phi of x times capital phi of y. So it decomposes to a product of two functions. On one function just depending on x and the other just depending on y. For simplicity, we assume that the small phi is normalized. So this integral over the modulus squared of small phi of x dx is equal to 1. Now we see that in this case, if we plug in this wave function into this equation here for the conditional wave function, we see that the conditional wave function for the x system in this case is always small phi, irrespective of what the y system does. And this conditional wave function actually in this case also is an effective wave function. It satisfies the Schrödinger equation on its own. But the condition to have the wave function of the universe split to be a product of a function just depending on x and just depending on y is far too strong a condition. Because even if it's true at some time, say t0, it would be immediately destroyed even by the weakest interaction between the x system and the y system. So by the weakest interaction between our system and on the consideration we want to describe and the rest of the universe. Now, let's look at another example to get closer to where we want to arrive, so to get a handle on when the conditional wave function actually is an effective wave function. So let's consider that the wave function of the universe, capital Psi of x and y, is now a sum of two terms, capital Psi 1 of x and y plus capital Psi 2 of x and y, where psi 1, or let's write it this way, where the support in y of psi 1 of x and y intersected with the support of in y of psi 2 as a function of x and y is empty. That means psi 1 and psi 2 have disjoint y support, which means if we take a y, a specific value of y, so of the coordinates of the rest of the particles in the rest of the universe, and plug it into say psi I, such that psi I is unequal to zero, so we choose such a y that this psi 1 is unequal to zero, then psi 2 will be equal to zero, and vice versa. Now, this splitting of the wave function into a sum of two summons that do have disjoint y support is actually not as artificial as it might seem at first sight. It's not a rare case, because keep in mind that the configuration y, so of the particles of all the rest of the universe, is actually a collection, as I said, of all the positions of all the particles in the rest of the universe. So it's a collection of y1, y2, y3, and so on. And to have the splitting into y supports, it's enough to have it for just one yk, so for just one particle coordinate for one particle in the rest of the universe. This is always the case if we have two clearly distinct states for possible distinct states for the rest of the universe, two clearly alternative states. Now, the more general formulation we need to arrive at an effective wave function for the subsystem comes from the combination of these two simple examples. So suppose that for some time interval, let's call it I of t, so some interval of time, the wave function of the universe, psi of x and y, is of the following form. It is the function small phi of x times capital phi of y, so a product, plus a function capital psi orthogonal of x and y, where, as above, the support in y of phi of course does only have a y support, intersected with the y support of capital psi orthogonal is the empty set. So they have disjoint y support, as above. Then the conditional wave function, or what I should mention probably, what I didn't say up in the example above, if we have this case here, so where the wave function of the universe splits into a sum of two functions, psi 1 and psi 2, that do have disjoint y support, then if we know that the actual configuration of the rest of the universe is in the support of one of them, they have disjoint y support, then we can simply forget about the other wave function and say for instance y is in the support of psi 1, then we can just forget about psi 2, and psi 1 of the capital Y of t plugged into it actually provides the conditional wave function for the X system, so we can basically forget about the other part. This is also of crucial importance here, because if now Y is in the support of phi, then we can basically forget about this orthogonal part here. So if this is true for some time interval, let's say this is true in the time interval I of t, then we can forget about this part here, and we see that the X system actually does have a conditional wave function phi. As a conditional wave function, it does have phi x, just by plugging in this formula into the definition of the conditional wave function, and this also is an effective wave function for the X system. So it satisfies a Schrödinger equation on its own, independently of what the Y coordinate explicitly does, as long as the Y coordinate is just in the support of capital phi. Of course, then also the X system is in the support of small phi. Now, this actually provides us with what we wanted originally, namely a wave function for the X system that does both jobs, that first guides the X system and secondly satisfies a Schrödinger equation for the X system, both independently of what the Y system explicitly does. Now, One should note that this entire scheme, this entire all these concepts, this concepts, this derivation, made explicit use of the Bohmian configuration. So it is exclusively Bohmian and just possible in Bohmian mechanics. Another thing we should mention is that in one of the previous chapters, we mentioned the wave function of a subsystem, and we said that we need to, or we will come to how to derive the wave function of a subsystem given the wave function of the universe, and that we need that in deriving the Born rule from the measure of typicality of the universe. So this is exactly that what we were referring to. So we exactly did this here. Now let us, to conclude this section, apply what we just did to a measurement-like situation, because we will see that in a measurement situation, we can this way derive the Kolob's wave function after the measurement. So we know from the last section that if we have an interaction between a measuring apparatus and a system to be measured, then after the measurement, the wave function, the combined wave function of system and apparatus will generically look like the following. So it's a psi of x, x is the system to be measured, y is the apparatus, or maybe including the environment, as capital T just denotes that it's after the measurement, is equal to a sum, ci phi I, the T just denotes it's after the measurement of x, capital phi I of y, where, as above, so this is a special case of what we had just above, the phi i's, the capital phi i's, the supports of the capital phi i's are disjoint. So capital phi I, capital phi j, the supports are the empty set if phi is unequal to j. So they have disjoint y supports. So now looking at this expression we just have after a measurement situation, we see, as we said, it's a special case of what we just did before. We see that after this experiment, after the measurement, the X system can actually be described independently of the Y system because it admits a wave function, an effective wave function for its own description. The effective wave function for the X system is then given by phi k of X if Y of, let's denote this by capital T, so after the measurement, is in the support of capital phi k. Thus we recover the Kolob's law, or the Kolob's of the wave function of ordinary quantum mechanics, and give precise meaning to the notion of the Kolob's wave function by this derivation. Now, of course, Bohmian mechanics is a deterministic theory, so to which one of the phi k's or the phi i's in the end, or which one of the phi k's we get in the end, is of course uniquely determined by the configuration of the X system and the Y system, let's say before the measurement, so by the initial configuration of the X and the Y system.